Come on.
Hello and welcome to the Tottenham Way podcast, the season review episode. I'm joined by Dan Kilpatrick as usual. Hello, Dan. How are you, sir?
Hello, Tom. I'm very well, thank you. Slightly jaded of doing Tottenham season review podcast. This is my third one. I've been a bit of a... I've been like that player after a kind of mixed result that has to front up and do all the media and just go and do the rounds and do Sky and do the BBC and do TalkSport. And then by the end, they're just kind of repeating themselves and answering the same questions and saying the same thing. I think I now know how that feels, or I will know how that feels in 45 minutes.
So, but don't worry, listener. it's not going to be too bad. We're not going to just repeat the same old things. We have got a fun-filled 30 to 45 minutes here. It's been such a weird season. And there's obviously been one major talking point, which we can't skip over. But really, if you take that out of the equation, it's probably one of the most forgettable seasons in living memory. You know, COVID made it relevant, I suppose, in a way. Like, we've had a runaway title winner who pretty much won it in October onwards. There's not really any kind of fallen giant stories. I suppose you could look at Arsenal, maybe even us, if you like, considering, you know, we finished on a Champions League final last year. Not really any major relegation race until like the last couple of weeks. It's just felt a bit flat overall, is it not? Is it difficult to review a season that's been that kind of free of real drama?
I mean, I think that for Spurs has been really memorable in that it will always be the season when Pochettino was sacked and Mourinho came in. But you're right in saying, I think if we forget about the Premier League as a whole and forget about other teams, you're right in saying that it's been both really forgettable and also unforgettable. It's going to be immortalised by the Amazon Fly on the Wall documentary, so even if we want to forget it, we won't be able to, because that is really going to immortalise it. But at the same time, on the pitch, there hasn't been that many games that I really look back on and think, oh yeah, that'll live long in the memory. It's felt contradictory in that way.
You mentioned there the Amazon documentary. Now, here's an interesting one, because I keep forgetting that that's happened. And when it comes out, because of the season that we've had, it is going to be a bit of a car crash viewing. But you'd kind of imagine that Amazon are absolutely delighted about it in a way. Do you get any feeling from the club, from speaking to people at the club, that they're at all, I don't know, worried, or are they quite delighted that there's a bit of drama to draw a large viewing audience in? Because the advert, the preview seems to be a lot around sacking Poch and bringing in Jose. So I don't know if maybe it's a bit more than that.
I think sacking Pochettino and bringing in Mourinho is obviously going to be the centrepiece of the show, as it was the centrepiece of the season as well. But look, honestly, I think they released a trailer recently that was kind of a bit of bromance between Dele and Dyer and some of the guys playing FIFA, I think, or playing a video game. And it was all kind of very creamy and very, very buddy. And look, Spurs have editorial control over this. I don't know if Mourinho himself does. I think he said he's not going to watch it, but I've no doubt that Daniel Levy will be watching this and deciding what goes in it and what doesn't. So I really don't think there's going to be a huge amount in it that really paints the club in a negative light. I mean, I think it's going to be entertaining because it can't fail to be given some of the stuff that's happened. But at the same time, I mean, ultimately, this is a form of PR for the club. It's a way of selling the club around the world with an inside look at it. So it's going to be heavily edited. It's going to be heavily controlled. And I don't imagine there's going to be anything in there that really makes us gasp and think, oh, how awful that is for Tottenham. That there'll be a lot of kind of nice stuff, as we saw in the trailer, which I think, look, for people like us, for fans and reporters and just even football fans in general, I think will still be really interesting. But I don't think it's going to be high drama. I mean, I think by way of comparison, the one I've watched most recently is the Sunderland one, and I believe Netflix did not give Sunderland editorial control. So there are some bits, you know, where the manager's like, don't bid more than 2 million for Will Grigg, and then the chairman bids like 6 million for him. In a desperate panic on deadline day and looks really stupid. I don't think that kind of thing is going to make the cut at Spurs.
I would imagine if you are depressed.
If that happened, I'm not.
Yeah. But I'd say if you are depressed after watching the Spurs documentary and you haven't seen Sunderland Till I Die, I would advise to go and watch it straight after that. If you think that Spurs are in a bit of disarray this season because of the season we've just had, my God, if you see what's happened to that football club of that size, it does put it into a bit of perspective, doesn't it? Sunderland Till I Die is a great documentary. Do check it out if you haven't seen it. I really enjoyed it.
It's great. My girlfriend, who's not hugely into football, got instantly drawn into Sunderland Till I Die after about 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes of Charlie Methven, the kind of eccentric, posh CEO, who I'm ashamed but also quite amused to say, went to my school.
I knew he would have done. Everyone in Oxford went to the same school, I swear.
Yeah, 5 minutes of him, just compelling television. So, thoroughly recommend watching that.
Back to Spurs. So, it wasn't a good season. We're not going to drill down too far into it, but I did think it was worth asking the question, really. And I know hindsight is 2020, but Was it really that shocking to have a season like this after probably the height of Pochettino's reign was the 16-17 season? And if you look at the Champions League run last season as a series of freak accidents that managed to get through, I mean, we'd never replicate that in a million years. You look at the City and the Ajax results. But apart from that, it's felt a little bit on the slide for about 18 months. And so, was it massively surprising for us to have a season when we've ended up finishing sixth? Again, I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but it just feels as if that kind of feels quite fitting considering the football we've been playing for probably pushing 2 years now. Is that maybe unfair or?
Possibly a little bit unfair, but I think you're right in saying that the Champions League final feels like such an anomaly, and actually it distorted everything around this season. I think one thing I've been writing about a little bit and trying to get my head around a little bit in the last couple of weeks was that concept of perception versus reality that Pochettino would not stop banging on about. And he almost said it in every press conference for about 6 months. You know, it was perception or reality. And he said it so much that he started to apologise for it by the end. He said, I know I've said this a lot and I know it's boring, but you need to think about the perception, the reality. And even though he said it so much, I never really had an idea what he was on about. But I think I do now, after this season. Yeah, I think the Champions League final created this perception of the club that was still on the up, a squad that was still reaching new heights and achieving new things. And obviously the reality that he saw at the training ground day to day was that the squad was massively in decline, that it was stale, that it needed breaking up and refreshing. And he was also saying that in public. And I think the big thing about this season under both Pochettino and Mourinho is it's kind of been difficult to know whether the manager's been underachieving or the squad. So if you take Mourinho's tenure, certainly his early months, in some of the poorest performances or some of the underwhelming performances, you weren't sure whether it was Mourinho kind of failing to get the best out of a decent team or whether there was just nothing a manager could do and these players are all shot and past it. And after so many games this season, I've just had that feeling like, you know, is Mourinho a busted flush? Is he yesterday's man? Is he just failing to pick up players who just got a bit stale under old manager? Or are these players just broken beyond repair? And we're still not really sure about that one. But I think we're getting a little bit closer to it. But that for me, that question, manager versus players, is kind of been the big question around the whole season, and I think ultimately was the reason Pochettino was sacked, I suppose, because Levy chose the players over the manager.
We certainly looked an improved team. After lockdown, it was a bit of a weird one because we had some absolutely shocking performances, and if you think of the Everton game where we won 1-0 kind of felt really quintessential Mourinho under pressure, home game, winnable game, do the bare minimum to get out with 3 points. And then I think that was followed by Sheffield United and Bournemouth, wasn't it? Which was, it kind of felt like a bit of a turning point.
Sheffield United was before Everton.
Oh, right. Okay. So, well, yeah, that kind of reinforces the point about needing the result, I guess, then. But Sheffield United certainly felt like a bit of a turning point because Mourinho, not that he's ever loath to do this, but was quite publicly damning of the players, probably collectively, maybe more than individually. And then if you think of the Arsenal result, which was massively significant, first North London derby in the new stadium, weird circumstances, obviously, but we weren't playing well. And that performance was probably one of the best we've had under Mourinho. And I'd put it up there with probably the Man City result in terms of playing the opponent and getting the result. And then was that the third to last game? We won the game after that, and then we drew with Palace, I think. But I think essentially what I'm trying to say is we lost one game in lockdown. And as poor as that was, it does kind of feel as if we ended the season on a reasonably positive note to finish sixth. So I get what you mean. And after each game, I change my mind almost. I can't decide what I feel about this team and if I kind of want it to succeed. That's going to sound stupid. I'm a Spurs fan, but like, I don't have the kind of love for this team as I did as when Pochettino was in charge, regardless of it being mostly the same players. So I flip.
We don't know how good some of those players are anymore, which is, I think, the point I'm getting at. I mean, is Dele Alli the player he was 2.5 years ago? Or is Eric Dier still got it in him to do what he did 3 years ago? You know, it's quite hard to say, isn't it? Whether these players are ever going to be the same again, or whether they just need to rediscover that confidence, rediscover that fitness, whatever it is that's missing at the moment. I still feel like some people see Alderweireld's name on the team sheet and think of 16-17 Alderweireld, or even 15-16 Alderweireld. And, you know, in that case, I think I can say pretty definitively he's not the same player. You know, he's lost, you know, he's lost a bit of something, whatever it is, whether it's a yard of pace or just sort of sharpness in his head and in his feet. So I think that, yeah, that has been a really strange aspect of the season, kind of reevaluating what we thought we knew about the squad. And I think we would have done that much sooner and much more easily without the Champions League final run.
You know what they say is when you fall in love with something or someone, you remember it in that moment, not in the years after where things decline and decay. You know, that's the romantic way that I'm looking at it, which is why it hurt to see people like Rose and Eriksen drop off so massively and then end up going, you know, relative peanuts, or, well, Rose isn't officially gone, but as good as. Yeah, it's a strange one. Let's try and turn this around. Just a quick question before we move on. We're going to talk about Vertonghen because I think it's a shame that not more was made of his departure, or could be made of his departure because of the lack of fans. But just a quick question on the COVID situation. Spurs were in a real mess before COVID and lockdown. And I think on the first podcast we did in the lockdown tapes, or whatever it is we called this series, that it could have been a bit of a blessing in disguise, as horrible as that might seem. But if we look at it in purely football terms, Kane and Son were coming back from long-term injuries, and in the end Kane was probably finishing the season in some of the best form he's been in for Spurs for a while. Where do you think we would have finished if COVID hadn't happened? Let's say none of it existed and none of it spread across the world and caused the havoc that it did. I genuinely think we would have finished 9th, maybe 10th, because it wasn't actually that close. You look at Arsenal, where only finished a couple of points behind us in the end, and they did come 9th. I think we really could have been realistically looking at a just about a top 10 finish, maybe worse.
I think Spurs could have been looking at bottom half quite easily. I mean, I really like this counterfactual, because I think it's just really interesting to wonder what would have become of Tottenham's season, because this shutdown could not have come at a better time. And I know it's slightly glib and it feels a bit inappropriate to talk in this way about something that's cost so many lives, but it could not have come at a better time in a sporting sense for Tottenham, because the rut they were in and the downward spiral of negativity, to borrow a phrase from a former Spurs manager, it just felt like it was going to continue. And obviously the shutdown came just after the 3-0 defeat at Leipzig, which was a game kind of people weirdly went into with some optimism. I suppose it was related to Mourinho's Champions League record, in the sense that Spurs had the experience in the competition and he had the experience and Leipzig and Nagelsmann didn't. But they, you know, really blew Spurs away. And you have Mourinho kind of wishing the season away. He'd almost thrown in the towel. It wasn't just Kane and Son, remember. It was Sissoko, who's obviously made a huge difference. And then Bergwijn as well, who's going to miss the whole season. So you're looking at going into the last nine games with Dele, Lamela and Lucas as the front three, basically, given Mourinho was reluctant to play Troy Parrott. So I would have, Man United would have comfortably won that game. West Ham would have sent blood and been up for it, so you'd think they would have probably done a number of Spurs. So I could have seen it going south very, very quickly. And I think, you know, Mourinho's always been quite keen to write off this season. You know, even when it's been going well, he's been in an optimistic mood and the results have been going well, he's always said, you know, let's start next season with a clean slate, with no points deficit. So he's been consistent in that. So I think he would have just continued to be consistent and say, you know, this season's a write-off essentially. But the mood around the club would have been very bad. I think the perception of the club from the outside would have been, you know, a club on the down. Mourinho, a manager past his best and kind of moaning rather than looking for solutions. And you know, that might have affected the summer transfer business. That might have affected the happiness of players like Kane. So I think it would have been fascinating, but quite grim, I think.
And people took the piss out of... There was a bit of piss-taking of Mourinho for almost celebrating with the whole staff for finishing sixth. But you kind of wonder if there was an element of that, of maybe feeling as if they got away with it a little bit. And I know, I agree with you, it does seem a bit glib, and it is a strange thing to say in circumstances that came about. But it could have been pretty nasty for Mourinho. And don't forget as well, there was the Dyer incident literally just before lockdown, after we went out to Norwich in the Cup as well. And it was all... really was all pointing in a wrong direction for Spurs. 4 months later, we've got Kane fit, Son fit and winning awards. Kane up for the July Player of the Month. Jose's up for Manager of the Month for July. We've got all these players back and sort of hitting form with a six-week break coming up. And Dyer's getting himself a new contract. It just feels as if we had a very organic cut-off there somewhat. But let's move on. Let's talk about Vertonghen. Didn't play a single minute after was it Bournemouth when he played? I can't actually think of his last game. He certainly didn't come on against Palace.
I believe it was Bournemouth. Yeah, it was the first game that Dyer was suspended. He played, and it looked like he might be the surprise replacement for Dyer. And then I think Sanchez came back in for the remaining five games or games.
Dyer played the Palace. Of course.
So, yeah, I think he got on against Newcastle and Everton in stoppage time, literally. So, and possibly against Sheffield United as well. So, I think he had a few kind of farewell appearances, but I think in much the same way that Mourinho, by the end, was only really using Eriksen when he had to. I think, given that he obviously knew Vertonghen was going, he was pretty reluctant to put him in. And I think, you know, to be honest, even with 5 years on his contract, he wasn't starting ahead of Alderweireld, Sanchez and probably Dyer.
I consider his leaving nothing like Eriksen's, nothing like Rose's, nothing like Walker's, very much more of a sort of Dembele, probably known for a few months before the decision or final decision was taken, or the decision became clear that it wasn't going to be extended, and his body, it was starting to fail him at the level of the Premier League. I think he still could do a job in the Champions League. He was kind of that sort of level of classy player that could still do the job at that level, but it was quite obvious that he wasn't able to manage the pace, and particularly when we kept using him at left back a bit towards the end of last season as well, it just did not seem to be the job for Jan anymore. And people talk about no trophies and things like that, but he leaves a legend, doesn't he? He really typifies Spurs in a way of that kind of sometimes class over substance. And I don't mean that as in a derogatory way, because he had plenty of substance as well, but he was one of the classiest centre-backs we've ever had. And for him to come in literally within weeks when Ledley King retired in 2012 just felt like a real passing of the torch in that regard. Do you have any favourite Jan memories? I always hear about how he was a good interviewee and always good in the mix zone, very thoughtful, and gave some really, you know, honest, intelligent insights. I hope that's true.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, on that front, a couple of years ago, I did an interview with him at a hospital visit. So when the Spurs squad go around local hospitals and kind of see children around Christmas and give them presents, I did an interview with Vertonghen, and it was in the games room of the hospital. Literally on those tiny plastic chairs for children, kind of perched on one of those each, and a Spurs press officer was perched on another. So it was a slightly comic scene. And I think because we were surrounded by games, we got on to talking about games, and his face kind of lit up, and he's got a genuine passion for board games and card games and stuff. So I kind of ended up interviewing him about that, and I was sort of conscious that maybe I was wasting an opportunity to get into him about Spurs, but I ended up really enjoying the piece because he talked about the Uno Championship. He talked about how the team kind of bonded over, I can't remember the game, Settlers of Catan, which I've never played.
Never heard of him.
Well, I've never heard of it. And he talked about how Moussa Dembélé was afraid to play him at chess, and he'd obviously known Dembélé since they were teenagers, but they were scared to play each other at chess because basically they were such good mates that the pain for the loser would have been so intense and the ribbing for the winner. And I kind of know I've got a mate who I don't like playing tennis against because it just wouldn't be good for the friendship and would be unpleasant because we're so competitive. So I totally understand what he meant. So yeah, he was a good interviewee, and he always had time to sort of stop. So, and as a footballer, he didn't seem particularly typical. I think he kind of lived in North London, sort of in the Hampstead Highgate area. His missus was an actress and was very involved in theatre. He was quite a kind of cultured bloke who had a lot of other interests beyond football. And yeah, obviously as a player, he was a fantastic player. And as you said, looking back, everyone must have felt a bit sick when King announced his retirement, albeit he had kind of faded in the few months before that. But to have Vertonghen come in and then immediately get in the PFA Team of the Year, you know, rarely can a club legend have been replaced so effectively. It was just that was a really great summer, if I remember the transfer business. And Vertonghen was arguably the best.
Yeah, he came in. It's really funny to think of him coming so so soon after Redknapp left. He was the start of AVB's reign. And you think about Jan now, and you make links between players and teams. And I forget that Jan Vertonghen came in right at the start of Bale's massive monster season that he had. And the next season he had such a, well, he was part of a poor Spurs team and had some symmetry with what's happened this year, but he was in a bad team. And he had such a way about him that seemed quite disinterested. And in a team that isn't performing very well at the time, it went down quite badly with some sections of the fan. And I'd include myself in that. I did see him as a kind of a luxury player in a way. He was somebody that wasn't necessarily in it for the long haul, and I thought he was pretty close to leaving.
Didn't get PFA Team of the Year that season, or am I?
That's the season before. So the season before was when he first joined, which was the season Bale had a monster year. Season after was AVB and Sherwood. AVB and Sherwood, I mean, and clearly It's quite funny to think of the players that we consider a little bit more thoughtful in that team. So the Eriksons and Vertonghens both quite clearly had an outward disdain for Tim Sherwood, which maybe says it all. But at that point, and I don't know if you'll remember this, but I remember in one of our very, very early Tottenham Way episodes, probably the second or third episode, I made the big call that Vertonghen was going to be replaced before Christmas even by Eric Dyer in centre back, because I just didn't think Jan really gave a shit anymore. And which is, I mean, it couldn't possibly be more of a wrong call, because I think those two seasons, those two title challenging seasons that Spurs had, Alderweireld gets talked about a lot, but Jan was incredible in those, in that kind of left centre back, left back of the three role. He was perfect for that. We talk about some players being tailor made for that 3-5-2 that Poch had for a very fleeting moment in the middle of that 16-17 season. But Jan at left centre back of a three, being able to kind of maraud up in the way that he used to through midfield and get himself into dangerous position, it was just perfect for him. And that is the Jan Vertonghen that I will remember 100%.
Yeah, that's a great point. When I was doing one of the other podcasts, James Moore was saying on the Athletics pod that Vertonghen was a kind of totally different player in his first season. I think he scored 6 or 7 goals and he used to really bomb forward from centre half. And I remember when Poch introduced a back three, he was the one that kind of had the license to go while Dyer and Alderweireld sat. And you could tell that he was absolutely loving it and playing with a real freedom again. And I think this sort of movement built up around getting a goal for him because he hasn't scored for so long. And I can't remember when he broke that, but I remember there were a couple of kind of half chances beforehand. When,
I think it was Wimbledon in the FA Cup. I think I remember the chance that you may have, sorry to interrupt, but I think I may have remembered the chances, one of the chances, and this is probably one of my favourite Jan memories, but it was against Liverpool in the 4-1 at Wembley, and it was the fourth goal.
He gets furious.
Jan, I think his shot is blocked by like a miraculous block on the line, and then it falls for Kane for a 1-yard tap-in. And as everyone's going mad, we've just gone 4-1 up against Liverpool, Wembley's rocking, all the players go mad. You just see Jan getting this furious hands-on-head moment, like walking away pissed off. That's one of my favourite Vertonghen memories. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly liked getting forward. And I think the Dortmund game might, perhaps due to recency bias in part, but that might go down as kind of his most iconic Tottenham performance, I think. And he's just fantastic. And when he did that interview at the training ground to sort of say goodbye, he made a point of saying, "I was out of position." You know, he never said it when he was still contracted, but it was a very open secret that he loathed playing left back.
Yeah.
But he was, he obviously did it a lot for Belgium, and when he did it for Spurs, he was always pretty good, but never was he better than in the Dortmund game, when he just got a great goal and a great assist as well, and just kind of ran the entire flank. And that was probably his last really sort of outstanding performance. And you know, obviously the start of the season, he was mysteriously dropped from the team by Pochettino. And, you know, again, I think everyone was up in arms at the time. But again, it was, for me, that's another sort of perception against reality thing. I mean, the reality was Pochettino knew he was in decline. Pochettino knew he probably wasn't going to sign a new contract, and he knew he had to build for the future. But you know, at the time, we were all kind of firing questions at him. You know, Twitter, at least, seems very unhappy about it, because the perception was still that this was the Vertonghen from 16-17 that you were just talking about. And you know, again, I just come back to that because it does just sort of feel like the story of the team over the last 18 months.
It's quite clear from those presentations at the training ground how highly regarded he was. It was a little bit awkward that it was also done at the same time as Mickey Vorm's goodbye present.
Yeah,
as well.
They had to do one for Vorm, so they did one for Vorm.
Vorm got a watch from the club shop. But Vertonghen got quite a nice, he got personalised Super Jan. I think it might be him celebrating against Dortmund for the goal, and he's doing like the Super Jan shirt rip thing. It's got like a Superman superimposed underneath. it's a really nice touch, and you get the sense that he does hold the club in very high regard as well. I think the Pochettino years were kind of the making of him a little bit. And you do wonder, with everything we've said so far, that kind of the intelligent player, intelligent man, affiliation with the club, you know, we can posit that he might be a romantic, but is it too romantic an idea to think of him coming back in a few years and coaching, managing? Do you think he's going to go down that route?
Really hard to say, as I said, because he's the kind of person that just clearly has other interests. You know, he could sort of do a Ramon Vega and just pop up doing something completely different, I think. Actually, not that Yamatonga should ever be compared to Ramon Vega. I massively apologise for that. But yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I think from sort of day one, that there are players that feel like proper Spurs players. They just feel right. And there are players that don't feel right. And I think from day one, Vertonghen's just felt right. It's felt like he's just felt very Spurs, I think. So, and then that's a kind of intangible in a way, but you've touched on it. It might be he's a bit classy. Maybe even that he's a sort of tiny bit flaky deep down. I don't know. But I could definitely see him being back. And I think he said it himself. Like, I always feel like I could be welcome back here. So I'm sure it's not the last we've seen of Jan. And to be honest, I would be disappointed if the club didn't arrange something when fans were back in the stadium to get him over here. And don't invite Vaughan. No, you don't need to invite Vaughan to this one.
Yeah.
But, you know, get Vertonghen out on the pitch. Bring Dembele if you want, you know, just for company, whatever. But get him a chance to say goodbye at half time next season after Christmas when everyone's back in, hopefully. Because I think that would be, you know, a really special moment, and I think it would be a shame if it didn't happen.
Half time, 15-minute speed game of chess, Dembele, Vertonghen, winner gets coach position. Sold.
Perfect. Yeah.
Who knows? He could be doing some sort of joint management with Ledley King as well. We mentioned at the start of this that Jan almost took the torch from Ledley King at centre back, and so there's a nice symmetry with Jan leaving and Ledley King coming back in his coaching position. What do you make of that? It's not something I've ever really considered King being all that interested in. Don't know particularly know where that idea comes from. I don't think I've ever heard him speak about coaching in any sort of positive or negative light. He's been an ambassador for the club since retiring, obviously, and he opened the Sainsbury's and all sorts of things. But Jose's brought him in as a defensive coach, isn't he? So what's the story there? Have you heard anything interesting about the decision making behind it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a great thing if it's for the right reasons. So that's the kind of question here. And I think if Mourinho has seen something in King, who has been in and around the group and apparently helped out in lockdown, was working with the defensive players. If Mourinho has seen something and thought, you know what, I can really work with this guy and there's something there that I recognise, then fantastic, because I think, you know, frankly, everyone loves Ledley and he's a good bloke and was an even better player. So why not? Because it ticks a lot of boxes. You know, it's a cost effective way to replace Ricardo Formichino, who's going to pursue a management career, obviously at a time when the club doesn't have huge money to spend on a replacement. So it ticks that box. It's a good PR move. It gets a club legend on Mourinho's team, helps to detoxify Mourinho somewhat in the eyes of supporters who perhaps still have an issue with him. It gives an opportunity to a BAME coach, which obviously is really important at the moment. It's something that, you know, top clubs should be striving to do. So it's good in loads of ways. I just hope that those sort of three or four reasons aren't the reasons it's happening and that he's being foisted on Mourinho for those reasons. I hope it's been driven or a collaborative thing that's sort of come from Mourinho or been worked on with him, because, you know, he's saying the right things at the moment, but if things did turn sour down the line, you know, and he's had an appointment essentially foisted on him, then he's not gonna, he's not gonna forget that. But there's absolutely no indication that that's the case. I'm just saying, I hope it's not, but I think it seems like a really, really good thing that I can only be positive about. I will just say one more thing. Eddie's been on every pre-season tour, and he kind of shows incredible patience to get wheeled out at, you know, endless events and sort of 45 degree heat in Singapore and stuff. And he's often available for interview and for a chat. And I've got to say, just personally, I didn't think this was the path he would go down, because he did do a bit of under-18s coaching part-time. And I remember speaking to him a few years ago, and he just said he found it almost quite stressful and had a few sleepless nights kind of worrying about it. So he didn't seem sure of it, and I wasn't sure that he was going to go down that route. But, you know, he stuck around the club, and he's obviously kind of gradually got more involved in mentoring and taking the odd session here and there. So it's quite nice to see someone not kind of jump into something, but take their time to consider it. And I think he's still only 39. He retired relatively young, of course.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It's kind of quite admirable.
Yeah.
He just said, I'm going to be a coach, or I'm going to be a pundit. You know, he seems to be quite thoughtful and to have almost gone on this kind of mini journey back into coaching.
And under normal circumstances.
His role is still unclear, by the way. It's not clear that he's going to be. I don't think he's going to be a defensive coach.
Right.
The guy he's replacing is a tactical analyst, so he'll do something on Mourinho's staff that's not necessarily, you know, bibs and balls and cones.
Yeah. I think it's a good point what you mentioned about his age as well and retiring early, because if he retired, I think he was 32. So if he retired that young, it would be very unusual for someone that young to go into coaching at all. So 38 is usually around about the time that ex-players would probably look at that if they didn't get an opportunity immediately. So yeah, good point, Dan. It's a very good point. Very, very insightful.
Thank you, Tom.
That's why you're the journalist. Let's talk about. We can start wrapping this up a bit. I think, as you've said, it's been done to death about the themes of the season, if you like. I think there's no doubt that we're all quite happy to see the back of it for all the reasons that we've already gone over. But there's been some positives for sure. I think we mentioned about the improvement in form towards the end of the season, and a lot of that went down to Kane returning to fitness and Son returning to fitness. But Kane, when he starts playing those balls like he did against Leicester and starting to hit shots like he did that second goal against Leicester, you know that he's back in business and he's starting to feel it a bit. And that is exciting to think of him staying fit and coming back next season. New contracts for Dier, as we've already mentioned. So it's quite obvious that Mourinho trusts him and sees something in him, which we always kind of wondered, especially as he targeted him when he was at United. But new contract for Tanganga as well. Really good news. Had a very much a breakout season. Bergwijn looked good from when he came in. Him with a pre-season is really exciting. Lo Celso had a full season in him. He's a little bit hot and cold, but you'd like to think that it will tip more in favour of him when he is on form next season. So there's some things to look out for sure. And you feel as if that is a really solid foundation to build on, isn't it? The other thing I was going to mention is Lucas, who just seemed to explode in the last three or four games and was like unplayable. He was brilliant in the North London derby. And he's always looked as if he's had it in him, but it feels as if he's edged himself up the pecking order ahead of Bergwijn, maybe. How do you see Lucas in long term at Spurs? Because I would have had him down as somebody that would likely leave in the summer if it wasn't for these last four or five games.
No, I think as soon as Mourinho came in, Lucas was sitting pretty. He's such a Mourinho player. I don't think he's as good a footballer as Bergwijn, for instance, but I think he'll be the starting winger next season, because he's got everything Mourinho wants. He works hard. He's direct. He just puts in a phenomenal shift for the team, and you saw that in the North London derby. And I mean, he's really impressed me. I think in the last few games, he's actually been getting his head up and kind of almost threading these sort of Eriksen-esque through balls that I just did not expect from him at all. He's previously kind of looked like one of the most head-down players I'd ever seen. So he's definitely improving, and I think he'll be one of the biggest beneficiaries of Mourinho overall. He has been already. And I think, you know, given that every other forward was injured before the lockdown, I think he just run himself into the ground. Again, a pre-season for him, albeit this weird short pre-season and then a truncated, really intense season. Who knows who's going to react well or badly to that. But again, a few weeks off for him, quite encouraging. So yeah, I've been pretty impressed with him.
There are some things that will need ironing out over the summer and will be really interesting to see what happens next season. I can't be asked to talk about Ndombele. Don't have an opinion anymore. I think it's ridiculous for him to be lauded as the saviour of our midfield when he's as unfit as he is. I don't think we can trust him yet. Would love to be proved wrong because there's clearly a talented player there, but let's ignore that one. Sessegnon's an interesting one. Quite big money, young player. Still not 100% sure on what his final position is going to be, but if it is further forward, we are well stacked there. And as we've just mentioned, you know, Lucas coming into form, just as we've got Bergwijn coming in. Son's never really going to be under threat for his place, so we're quite well stocked there. So what do you think his immediate future is? Should we be a little bit worried? Should he be a little bit worried, I suppose?
Yeah, from what I have heard, it could be quite an interesting summer for Sessegnon. I think I don't think he's going anywhere permanently. I wouldn't rule out a loan, although with Europa League football, that would be quite a surprise now. But yeah, I mean, it's a funny one. I mean, I personally, not that this my opinion counts for anything on this one, but I think he should be a winger. I think when someone scores 16, 17 goals as a 16, 17-year-old, albeit in the Championship, you know, they've clearly got an eye for goal, and goals are the most precious commodity in football. You know, they're the most important thing. So nurture that and get them as far forward as you can. I don't see the point in him kind of being a reverse Bale and ending up at left back if you're taking away his ability to find the back of the net, which we saw, you know, Spurs fans saw for themselves against Bayern. You know, great finish on his debut. I'm a little bit surprised he hasn't played a single minute since the restart. I just can't see Mourinho playing him at left back. I'd be amazed if he ever started at left back when Davis was fit. So it's a difficult one for him because, as you said, where does he fit in? But I think he's definitely a talent, and it's easy to forget that. Kind of 2 years ago, we weren't talking about Sancho or Mason Greenwood or anyone else. You know, we were talking about Ryan Sessegnon, and he seemed like the big hope of English football. So there's something there. I think it's gone under the radar because of Ndombele, really. But that's another big challenge for Mourinho to get the best out of a really encouraging and not inexpensive summer signing.
Yeah, for sure. Another one who kind of fits that bill of where the more you look at this Spurs team, and if you look at the improvements that we made, a lot of that was when we switched to quite a flat 4-3-3, two wide men, Kane in the middle, and three across the middle in central midfield. And whilst I don't think we can really go on too much longer with Winks, Sissoko and Lo Celso as a team, because it just doesn't provide the cover that a kind of creaky defence desperately needs, I do think we'll go out and get a DM. I do really think it's going to be Højbjerg, and I'm not totally against that. We could do a lot worse. I don't know enough about him to have a particularly strong opinion, but if you consider that he slots into a midfield three, Lo Celso is an expensive and, as we've already mentioned, looks to be a very good player. You're looking at that final midfield spot potentially being taken by one of Ndombele, Winks or Sissoko, who continues, in my opinion, continues to prove his worth with how hardworking he is. And if you talk about players that Mourinho likes, Sissoko is definitely one of those. He's so hardworking and tactically very diligent and pretty intelligent with his with that positioning that he has. Where does Dele get into this team anymore? Because the, one of the most frustrating things I found under Poch as well was that Dele obviously he struggled with injuries for quite a while and he had a quite a patchy last couple of years. But when he was brought back into the team, he was used in areas that I just don't consider Dele Alli to be even remotely useful. And I think he's a great footballer, but his peak seasons for Spurs in those first in those title winning seasons was when he was between the width of the posts and in the penalty area. And it feels maybe a bit basic for a player of his talent, but you use players where they're best, surely. And Kane can drop off. He can play make. I don't really believe that Dele can perform the same role. But if we are looking at a 4-3-3 and we don't really have that dedicated attacking midfielder, the only place that he can come in is a false nine or on the wings. And so I wonder about him. And that might be me writing him off way too early, because when Mourinho came in, he was seemed to be one of his guys, didn't he? What was it, the whole, I want you to be Dele, not Dele's brother. But I worry about him. I just don't see where his string of games is going to come to regain his form.
I'm not too worried about that, really, in terms of him getting minutes. Because I think, as you said, when Mourinho came in, he made a point of kind of revitalising Dele and Dyer. That was his sort of thing, his big kind of early mission statement, to make those two the poster boys with the whole, you know, you're Dele's brother, and then putting Dyer back in midfield. So I think he really likes Dele, and I think can't really look into much since the restart, because he's just had another hamstring problem, which, you know, in and of itself is an issue, because he keeps getting them. But I could, there was quite a lot of matches since the restart where Spurs played a 4-2-3-1 setup. So they had two deep midfielders and the Celso pushed up to number 10. And I'm not actually convinced that the Celso is best there.
I think he's best
a bit deeper. So, you know, although this would mean dropping Sissoko, I could see a setup quite easily. I could see Spurs quite easily starting next season with someone like Højbjerg next to the Celso deep, and then Dele at number 10. And I think, yeah, as you said, when he's closest to Kane and when he's got a chance to make those clever late runs into the penalty box and move around, that's when he's at his best. And we saw a bit of that under Mourinho early on, you know, against West Ham, against United, when he scored that really kind of old Dele, brilliant goal. So there have been some encouraging signs. It would have been really interesting to see what he could have done since the restart with Kane and Son back. So I think more than anyone, he sort of needs those guys. And so that hamstring injury was pretty frustrating, actually, from a few perspectives.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel as if teams, regardless of how good a player is, if a team starts to click in a certain formation or certain partnerships and things, you can almost see a team moving on without them. And if we say that he's already a bit of an issue with his hamstrings, that has been going on a while. That's a good couple of years that he's been having this trouble. And if that does keep recurring, I might be writing his obituary way too early on that, but I just look at his form for 2 years-ish. He's been patchy at best, you'd have to say. He's been a bit streaky. He hasn't hit those that consistency of when he was 21, which is crazy to think about. Yeah, I'm worried about Dele long-term. But, you know, I'm sure he'll relish improving me, a overweight, middle-aged podcaster who comes back for 4 episodes per season. He will be absolutely relishing the idea of putting me into the dirt. I'm not going to ask you about transfers because it's boring, but we mentioned Højbjerg. We're hearing reasonably strong messages about the possibilities of him. If you could maybe just give us an idea of what do you get any impression from Spurs about where the priorities will lie? You'd imagine fullbacks has got to be up there, considering we've only got 2 kind of senior fullbacks in the whole squad, plus Tanganga to, bless him, try and fill in all the holes as and when they happen. But as far as I can tell, we've only got Aurier and Davis as first choice, as senior fullbacks in the entire squad.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's just common sense, I think. I mean, I'm sure there'll be a holding midfielder I'm sure fullbacks will be an area of interest. And then obviously Mourinho made no secret in January the fact that he doesn't think Son and Lucas are strikers. So I think there'll be an attempt to get someone to back up Harry Kane. But, you know, Pochettino tried to sign someone like that for 3 years, and it was nearly impossible until Llorente came along. So whether there's a suitable player who wants to be the understudy to Kane, we'll have to wait and see. But I think, yeah, the areas you mentioned, maybe a centre-half as well, but I do think Mourinho will be fairly encouraged by Alderweireld, Dier and Sanchez, and with Tanganga able to, in fact, Tanganga most comfortable there. Actually, it's not looking so bad at centre-half anymore.
Yeah, fair point. One word, just yes or no, Dan, Ibrahimovic.
No.
Thank God you said that. It's the sort of thing, we said it at the start of this about how Spurs are trying to get on the map. It just feels like the sort of stupid shit that we would try and pull. Sign Ibrahimovic, come to Spurs for 6 months, probably do not.
I'll be up for Troy Deeney.
Yeah, okay. I would. Fuck it. Yeah, why not? It might as well. You've said it. You've already said it. We've struggled to find a backup in the mould of good enough to play probably 10, 15 games a season, but not good enough to challenge Kane. Maybe that's perfect. Yeah, that would be weird. I'm looking at the relegated teams, and there's not an awful lot of business I'd be doing there, but it does kind of feel as if we could answer a few questions that the squad's posing by dipping into those three teams that went down. Probably Deeney, probably have a go at Callum Wilson, probably have a go at Aki at Bournemouth, maybe Max Ahrens. I don't know, maybe I'm looking a bit too low at that, but who knows, there may not even be any money for it, so we might just spend it all on Ibrahimovic. Should we wrap up there? That was a lovely season review, Dan. As I said, we only came back for 4 episodes, so it's a bit cheeky for us to come back and do a review of the season for the Tottenham way. But nonetheless, Skype's allowed us to do this. No, that's been brilliant. Probably won't be doing too many more of the lockdown tapes that we've been doing. This was only episode 4, I think it was, so we planned on doing quite a few more, didn't we, Dan? But in the end, it's been quite difficult. And you've obviously gone back to work. Has it been, let's finish off on that, everyone loves a bit of journo chat, has it been bizarre as you expected?
Yeah, it has, but it's weird how quickly you get used to this, or anything. People are just adaptable, aren't they? And it really does feel like the new normal now. So the first game against United that went to behind closed doors was really surreal. And kind of for the first sort of 10 minutes, you're just sitting there thinking, this is weird, I'll never get used to this. And then the last game at Palace, just totally normal to go in, sit 2 metres from everyone else, have the laptop on my lap, be in the stands, bring my own lunch, have no supporters, hear the players shouting, hear them out. You know, I'm just used to it. But, yeah, obviously, it's safe to say that whatever it is I love about football, you know, it involves the colour, the atmosphere, the noise. So I'm really looking forward to supporters coming back. Mm.
I didn't hate it anywhere near as much as I thought I would. At the start of this, I was dead against it coming back. I just thought it's impossible to bring it back and have any sort of experience that's similar. And in the end, I think they did a really good job on it. And I think the players commended, perhaps in light of recent events, maybe not the right word for it, but they did come back in difficult circumstances and a very odd schedule. You know, they're playing Thursday evenings and Sunday morning, and, you know, all sorts of weird times of the day and stuff. But I actually quite liked it. I don't know when we're going to speak again, Dan. Next lockdown.
So surely, are we signing off? Or
yeah.
All right.
We're signing off, Dan.
Are we still recording?
Yeah.
Sorry, you went into it as if it was just us chatting there. Like, I don't know when we're going to speak again, mate. It's, we'll hopefully do the second part with Adam Nathan on the cursed history of Tottenham at some point. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, the conspiracy theory will be back. Yeah, look out for that one. If not, I'm sure we'll be back at some point next season, probably for the quiz around Christmas. But yeah, for now, thank you very much for listening. Enjoy your very short summer until we're back again. Sayonara. Bye, Dan.
Bye.